This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today.
Shorty, get down, grab your keyboard. Got a website you must see now. For libertarian viewpoints, this is your joint. Turn the Fox News down. Commentary is a forte. Each and every day, true play away. I can't get it out of my mind. I think about the podcast all the time. A national to the state news. Trust these dudes, it's really, really cool. Spangle, Harrington, and Gold, it's not their fault. Government be acting like some fools. Greg Lance and Joe Ruiz got some entertaining things for you to read. Oh, baby, it's a perfect 10. You wanna get in, better read now so you can win. Oh, we are libertarians.
No diggity.
You gotta look it up. Are we a libertarian?
No diggity.
You gotta look it up. Are we a libertarian?
No diggity.
You gotta look it up. Are we a libertarian?
No diggity.
You gotta look it up.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians this week in what I am promising will be maybe one of the worst episodes we've ever had. For whatever reason, Greg thought it was appropriate to bring beers over to my house, and so now they're drinking during the podcast. Creighton's doing God knows what over there. Galt, we don't even know where Galt is. And
isn't he on a date?
Yeah, he is.
He's on a date?
I think so.
Galt's not on a date.
He is.
He doesn't have dates.
What's his name?
That is Maya Axton. Maya is sitting in this week, an expert in the Christopher Dorner case. And you can check out Maya's ramblings at creatingmaya.com. We do a podcast. Look it up in iTunes and check that out. It's pretty entertaining.
I think the people listening recognize that we do a podcast.
Maya.
They're listening to it.
Maya does a podcast. You pay attention if you're going to slam me. Gosh.
Lord.
So hatred right off the bat.
He's like an Alabama redneck. Over
I feel like I'm drinking in the middle of the podcast.
If it was the summer, I would totally be wearing my John Deere green trucker hat. I have a John Deere green. I have a Bass Pro Shops. I just switch out all throughout the summer.
Oh my gosh!
And I'm growing my beard back out.
You guys got to talk into the microphone, by the way.
This isn't going well.
Greg's over there. Oh man, no way. Oh, and he's not even talking in the microphone at all.
I just put in my 2 weeks at work, and they wouldn't let me have any facial hair. So now that I'm going to grow it out, and it's going to be trucker hat, grow out, put some grizzly in my lip.
Oh, yeah.
I'm bringing it back.
Yes, sir.
All right, well, that might scare off anyone who was thinking about taking us up on our next offer.
Just proving that libertarians are
a wide
range of demographics here.
Wide range of demographics. Yes. We have white males who range from 27 to 29, which is part of our problem. And we were called out on Facebook, but it's actually something we've been discussing lately. We are looking for guest female panelists. We're looking for ladies to come on the show who have an opinion and want. If you're in the Indianapolis area and you want to come on the podcast and come hang out, drop us a note on Facebook or send us an email at editor@wearelibertarians.com. It was pointed out to us that this podcast is a bit of a sausage fest, and we're going to try and rectify that. Although we do have...
Don't say sausage fest and then rectify in the same sentence.
Listen, I'm a wordsmith. I can't help it.
No, you're not.
get with us. If you're in the Indianapolis area, we're going to Skype some folks in, like Pepper Snyder, who lives in Marion, does Pepper Talks. She does a talk show on Indiana Talks. But we'd like to have some folks in... We'd like to have some ladies in the actual studio. Mostly because
real ladies.
Real ladies. Now that is Maya. Maya is transitioning from male to female. And we're not trying to insult you or anything, but we're looking for more of that feminine, soft, bouncy female type mentality. And you might be one of the angriest ladies I've ever met. You're like Roseanne if they close down Krispy Kreme.
Wait, did you just compare me to Roseanne?
Yeah.
I'm going to go home and kill myself.
Oh, we knew it was only a matter of time. So, all right. So, check out creatingmaya.com, and thanks for being here.
That was pretty deep, dark, man. it's only a matter of time. If you don't feel like killing yourself at the end of the day, we haven't done our job.
Maya and I have a very special way of talking to each other. It's full of,
I guess,
venom and hate. That's why we're good friends. We can speak to each other with absolutely terrible ways.
No filter whatsoever.
As usual, the first 5 minutes of the episode is an absolute waste of time. So let's get to something of substance. Let's talk about the State of the Union. Last night, President Obama came before Congress and gave the State of the Union, and I swore that CNN was just airing a replay from 2009 and 2010. I mean, he just goes up there and says the same exact thing every single year, but nothing really ever seems to change. For instance, one commentator last night made the comment that Tim Cook was sitting up in the balcony with Michelle Obama, and we haven't had, the Senate hasn't passed a budget since before there was an iPad, and we're on the fourth generation, and we have a mini, and Steve Jobs is no longer with us. That's how long it's been. I mean, if you can imagine a world without iPads, Lord knows Chris Galt can. But that's how long it's been since we've had a debate. Let's start with Greg. Greg Lenz is with us. Creighton is here. Creighton Harrington. And Greg, what were your impressions of the State of the Union last night?
Well, one, it was totally uninspiring. I mean, just like you said, he went back up there and repeated himself. And he's hell-bent on using redistribution as a remedy for middle-class wages being stagnant. He's absolutely convinced that even though he can't do it through wages, he can do it through extra benefits like Obamacare, more people on Medicaid, all different kinds of social programs. And I don't know. I don't think he gets it at all. I think what he's doing is just positioning himself to try to get the House back in 2014 and then really push an agenda forward.
Right. Blame the failure of the growth of the middle class and your suffering because of the House Republicans. There were even a couple funny memes, sorry, Creighton, that were put out by Democrats that had the no cat, grumpy cat, had its face over John Boehner's head. I thought that was kind of cute. Maya, what was your opinion of the State of the Union? And remember, we're on regular radio, so please no cursing.
Simple vote. Simple vote. That's the main thing I got out of it, is that the people that are part of tragedies need simple votes because they obviously can't vote for politicians. No, it was exactly what I expected it to be. I mean, they didn't actually say anything the entire time, and you know, he was a hypocrite amongst himself because he said we need to attract investors, but we're not allowed to have savings. So that was really neat. His understanding of economics, I mean, he should have been a economic professor in high school, not a constitutional, type of law. Wow. Teacher, so you know, because that would have been so much better for the poor kids that had to go under.
Are you okay, Creighton?
With how bad he's been on constitutional issues, I thank God every day he wasn't an economic law professor.
Could you imagine?
He would be even worse than he is right now.
Hey, when you're holding that mic, hold the metal part.
Is somebody's cell phone?
Yeah, it's the rattling that little cord. So, I edit that out. If you're one of the like three people that watches this on Google Hangout and we put it on our YouTube page, you get to see the things that everybody else doesn't get to see because I edit out all the bad parts. I found it completely uninspiring too. I thought it was just flat. It was the same old thing. There was nothing. There have been very few times, even though I didn't like George Bush and I disagreed with him on. I began his administration agreeing with a lot of what he said, and by the end, I hated his guts. Not him personally, but his policies. And there were still times that even he could make you feel a little bit inspired. Even he could sometimes make you go, all right, that was a really good speech. He kind of tugged at my heartstrings.
But Obama did channel a little Bush last night when he was talking about, you know, cybersecurity and everything else. I think he used almost some of the exact same phrases Bush did when he was talking about the Patriot Act and everything else. It was
right.
You see the little ticker there on the Bing. Little bit where it's like, you know, people's negative or positive reaction, and everyone loved it when he talked about taking away, you know, internet freedom. And just,
right.
He was using the exact same wording, phrasing, and reasoning when he was talking about arming other countries that we're going to go war with in 20 years from now. And when he was talking about taking, you know, bringing back CISPA and everything else, it sounded just like Bush. So he was inspiring last night.
Things like Bing. Bing last night had a special, they did a thing with Fox News where you went to bing.com/politics and you could watch a live stream and you could vote very negative, negative, positive, very positive on his statements every 5 seconds. And so what most of us did, and I included, we went on and just downvoted into the negative every single time he opened his mouth. Every 5 seconds. Very negative. even if he had said, we're going to end the Fed. Very negative. So, but he, so, it, and the negative was, it was like negative 30 was probably the average. But there are times where it creeps up where you're a libertarian and you go, oh, that is such a bad idea. And then you see it spike into the positive and you're like, morons.
Well, they have the whole chart still up there, and if you notice, all there's, you know, you could pick independent or other, Democrat or Republican, and they all spiked at the exact same times and dips at the exact same times. They follow each other. They're just a little bit separated from how negative they are, but they all jump at the exact same time, which is kind of an indicator of politics in this country.
Right. Yeah, it's times when you look at those graphs and you go, we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of persuading to do because there are a lot of people who don't see things our way. And it's a little bit discouraging, but you know, that's some of the work that lays ahead. Greg, what are some other points of the State of the Union that stood out to you?
Well, the education part was scary. I mean, we talked about this a little bit before, but yeah. That's the silver bullet. The solution is if everyone goes to preschool, the middle class wages are going to spike. We're going to found 10 Facebooks a month. I mean,
didn't he say like rape would drop if there were preschools?
Yes.
I think Maya pointed that out on Facebook. All right, so rape is going to drop if we have preschools? What the? It was just a bizarre statement. Even if there's facts, like, don't say it.
No, he's illogical completely. I mean, look at education statistics. Since we started Department of Education, our test scores in the globe have plummeted since we've spent trillions of dollars on it. And he thinks that he is the guy. He is a technocrat. He really is. And he thinks he can control everything. He reminds me of Carter in that way.
Yeah.
Well, even more on schools is you've got, he was talking about redoing how colleges are seen and how they're rated. And it's so the government's going to give us standards on what a good college is. That's, you know, that's frightening as well.
Yeah, I don't see how that's going to help us whatsoever. Creighton, you've been awfully quiet over there. What are you doing over there? Are you on Reddit?
No, I'm not on Reddit. I'm trying to do two things at once, and I'm not succeeding very well.
What are your thoughts on the State of the Union?
Well, wasn't able to catch all of it, but I've seen bits and pieces of it, and it's pretty much what I expected. Crap, crap upon crap, and more crap. I mean,
that was very. You know what, folks? You're not going to get analysis like that anywhere else. You can tune into other radio shows podcasts.
I can go into, like, you know, we need to raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour and save the world. And Galt made a point on Facebook and Google Plus, which he's been pushing pretty hard lately. If you guys, for those who aren't in our message feed that we organize these podcasts on, Galt loves Google Plus.
We basically have a running chat that we basically, all day long, we sit there and somebody posts something funny, or majority of the time is just making fun of Galt. So we promote how great Facebook is and how much we love Apple products. And he just loses his mind legitimately. He's like, no, Google is the best.
No, he is beyond infatuated with Google. Right. It's almost to the point where, like, we need to intervene.
I'm telling you, I shouldn't say that on air. Never mind.
Go ahead. I'll edit it out.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that Larry Page, the CEO, impregnated his mom and in order for it not to go public, gave her like shares of Google and that he's that are payable on his 25th birthday.
God,
that's the I've never like Apple fanboys are mild compared to Galt.
Compared to Galt, it's
incredible,
insane to me.
It's unreal.
I mean, I like Apple products. If you know, I have a Mac, I have an iPhone, I had an iPad till it got stolen, and I like Apple. But you know what? If Apple went out of business tomorrow, I could use a PC. I'd be okay. I'd get a Windows phone or an Android. No big deal.
BlackBerry.
No. We must use Google Docs. Dropbox sucks.
No, I know, right? Like when you said use Evernote. Google Docs is way. I remember
Google
one
Docs
time
is so much better than Evernote.
I remember the Young Americans for Liberty website. They integrate their website with Flickr, so our chapter would upload pictures to Flickr, and he chewed my head off because I wasn't using Picasa.
Oh my God!
I swear to God, man,
dude, I honestly think he would not date a girl if she had like an iPad.
No, I think you're 100% right.
I really do.
His mania is so deep.
If she ever sent him like a Word document to show him something funny, he'd lose his mind.
Today he posted a little thread, an article about how Microsoft wasn't gaining market share with Windows 8 and Windows Phone 7, and they're see people aren't buying the Surface because everybody likes the Nexus 7.
God. If you pulled 100 people on the street, I bet you they couldn't name two tablets. They'd just be able to name the iPad.
All right. We're just picking on him because he's not here.
Yeah.
And we know he's going to listen.
Fun.
I know. We love you, little guy.
He totally like catfished a girl for a date last night. It was fantastic.
Let's not get into that now.
I just want to clarify, I do not love Galt.
Oh, yes, you do. You left the thread last night. You got in some. We had a State of the Union thread, and if there's big events, check the Facebook page, which you can find through wearelibertarians.com. We had a thread going, and a guy had like 200-300 comments of basically just this kind of witty repartee. And you left at one point because Galt said something to you. What did he say?
Galt commented on my page. He's like, you know, why don't you just keep this on your page? And I was like, okay, I'll hop off the We Are Libertarians one. And what, 15 minutes passed, there was two more comments after I left.
Right. Because
Galt was posting what? He would post something about what the president said 15 minutes before. Everyone else is already onto the exact word Obama's speaking, and he's 15 minutes behind because he – I don't know what he was doing. He's probably like masturbating to Google. I don't know.
You know how long it takes to roll? Never mind. All right, let's get back to the State of the Union.
Can we talk about – I definitely want to bring up his blatant appeal to people's hearts on guns. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote.
Let's do that second because okay. That'll we'll transition
vote.
Into
yeah.
Super vote.
Super vote.
Super vote.
You wanted a super vote
last I want a
night.
Super vote.
Yes.
If Gabby Giffords gets a super vote, I want one. Let's talk about minimum wage, Mr. Economist. Why is the minimum wage a bad idea? It makes sense to me. If I go and I work at, you know, what, McDonald's or Hardee's or one of these places with minimum wage, I would love to make $9 an hour versus the $7 whatever it is. Why is that a bad thing?
And how is wanting to make $9 an hour related to the minimum wage?
Because that's what they want to raise the minimum wage to.
Oh, okay.
To $9.
So you're saying that if they raise the minimum wage to $9, then those who are working $7.25 will therefore get $9.
Right.
Wrong.
Why? What are you? You're such a cold, heartless jerk.
You're like a Republican.
It's because it's.
What are you, a Republican?
Do you want me to go into like? Okay, I'll break into like quick economic theory here. It's a price. Wages are a price. You know, the last time they tried price controls that everyone remembers is gas controls back in the 70s, and it led to shortages. Well, the same thing happens with wages, and that's why there is a permanent group of people that are unemployed because there is a minimum wage. The common analogy is that it removes the bottom rungs from the economic ladder because usually those that are unemployed are the poor and the young, and they've shown studies that inner city young are the worst, teenagers in high school and stuff, which...
By the way, inner city young, my DJ name back in college.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was.
Didn't you say your DJ name was something else? Like,
it's a joke.
Yeah, okay. Either way.
I went to IUPUI. We didn't have college radio.
So
barely a college.
So the The reason it doesn't work is essentially supply and demand are immune to political pull. You can't legislate away economic laws is the short answer, and it's economic laws that cause minimum wage to cause unemployment. The easy example is, like, just imagine, why don't we just raise – if the minimum wage causes people to have a decent living wage, then why don't we just raise it to, like, $1,000 an hour and we'll live to, like – we'll be, like, millionaires.
Okay. So a little bit on the other side, what are you going to tell all those people if you say in your perfect world you got rid of minimum wage? What about those people? What are you going to do?
With the ones that are – the ones that are that would work for less than minimum wage?
Well, no. What about all those people that are working minimum wage? If you remove minimum wage standards, those people are no longer, you know, the company owners aren't being forced to pay minimum wage. What are you going to tell all those people?
They're
going to pay me $7.25 if they get rid of minimum wage. I'm going to make $3 an hour, Creighton.
No, that's that logic is flawed, because you can use the same logic to say if the minimum wage is $7.25 and, you know, you're working a job at, say, $9 an hour already. If that logic applied, then all the wages would be forced down to the minimum wage. There would be no incentive to raise wages above the minimum wage. So if you got rid of the minimum wage, then there is no logical reason to say it'll go below the minimum wage if you're already working that job. You're working a job at $7.25 an hour because your labor is worth $7.25 an hour. If your labor is worth less than $7.25 an hour, you don't get hired at $7.25 an hour. You don't get hired at all. They don't hire you. So that's why people are unemployed, is because there are jobs out there, menial jobs, that are only worth less than $7.25. So rather than being paid $7.25 an hour and losing money, they just don't hire these people, and that's why they stay unemployed. Now, this doesn't mean that unemployment is a result. The unemployment problem in America is a result of the minimum wage by itself. What it means is there are menial jobs, entry-level jobs for usually that were always reserved for young people just entering the workforce, like high school part-time jobs. They don't get to work now at those jobs they could have because the minimum wage exists at such a level.
Right.
So it that's why they say it removes the bottom rungs of the economic ladder. Because usually you get a job that really pays crap and it's dumb work, but you work your way up from there. And you can't do that anymore.
There have been quite a few studies on that. And they did this, I think it was, 94?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? And
I felt like I was back in the Clinton administration. When he said it, I was thinking, we're really going to start arguing about minimum wage again? Really?
Yeah. I mean, the reason they want to do it, though, is because their primary concern isn't teenage employment and, like, individuals, you know, just graduating from high school, that didn't graduate from high school, that don't have any skills, like you said, menial wages. They're concerned about the productive working poor, the people who don't have, like, really marketable skills but still show up to work every day, work hard. They want them to be able to support a family on their wage. They're okay with giving up employment for teenagers, so they look at it as a raising the standard of living for families.
My dad ran a janitorial company in the 80s and 90s and hired hundreds of people over time, cleaning every bank, one branch in central Indiana, a couple other bank branches, several different, I talked about the post office last week, buildings, and those paid minimum wage. And some people used it they made an okay living doing it because they worked hard. And they didn't make minimum wage anymore because the harder they worked for my dad, the more responsibility they got and the more branches they were put in charge of, and eventually a management structure developed. And when minimum wage would hit, he'd lay people off because it's supply and demand. It's just like if you had – it's supply and demand for goods like beer or laptops. I mean, it's the same principle. You can hire, 75 people at – $7.50 an hour, or you can hire, 100 people at $5 an hour. So we can either have 100 jobs and have the chance of moving people up, or we can have less jobs and they're guaranteed that wage. The thing about those jobs that my dad had as an employer was that not a lot of people stayed very long. It was a very transient thing. I mean, and it was because they were either just worthless and they didn't want to put in a full day's wage and they'd get mad if he scheduled them over 32 hours because they lose their benefits, or they were younger and they were working in high school, they were working, in the summertime, and then they'd move on. But the people who had valuable skills that helped my dad's company didn't stay at minimum wage for very long. And, you know, that's an anecdotal study, but I think that is very typical of what goes on in the workplace.
Oh, yeah. Those jobs are just to establish your reliability.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you're not there very long. You're there to say that, hey, I can show up every single day at 8 a.m., and work hard, be there till 5 p.m., and then you're going to get a different job offer. You're just establishing a work history. So it's very rare they're supporting a family in those positions.
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard to believe that even Obama is as dumb enough to think that this is a good economic decision.
Oh, you're cute.
I disagree with the man on essentially everything that's ever exited his mouth, but I will give him the benefit of the doubt to say that he's just playing politics with this one. It has nothing to do with actually caring about anybody.
It actually can, because if you think about it, those jobs, those low-paying jobs, is where you learn business skills, where you learn, you know, different people skills. Well, now in this day and age, you don't learn those in the real world. You need to have those before you get a job, or no one wants to hire you. You're supposed to learn those in college or at some tech school or something else. So, you know, nobody wants to get a minimum wage job. That's not how people think. That's not how society works now. You go to school to learn those jobs, mount an incredible amount of debt, and then you have to have a higher paying job.
And you don't.
Most companies hire that way too. They don't want to hire a skillless person because they don't. I don't know when it changed, but it used to be a company wanted to hire a blank slate and then build the perfect employee. Now you don't get that. They want these people, their MBAs or going to college or something else. So no, it does make some kind of economic sense from their standpoint, is that, you know, they want to help control the economy and drive it in the right direction. Well, you need to have the higher minimum wage to steer the economy in the right direction based off of how society's built right now.
Well, I don't know, because if that's the logic they're operating upon, then the minimum wage is irrelevant because they're not hiring these people at minimum wage anyway. They're just waiting. I mean, all the minimum wage there then is just showing that, you know, we don't have a law saying that you can't work for less than this. Because if they're only hiring people that have the skills, and then they're going to hire them at the higher wage already, to just, I don't know.
You see where this all breaks down, though? That's simple logic. No. Remember, Krugman, the economy, economics is very, very hard to understand now. We have to have a degree to understand it. You're simplifying this way too down. People may understand.
No, you know, you're being sarcastic, but the truth is this that actually plays to a legitimate, you know, thought, a legitimate culture in, you know, scholastic circles, is that, you know, you can't. If you don't have this piece of paper saying, I mean, common sense is almost disregarded sheerly because it is common sense. It's like, if you don't have the training, then even if what you say is right, then, you know, you don't get the respect of being right. A lot of these things, a lot of the minimum wage, for example, I mean, this is stuff that's been known for centuries. I mean, this is stuff that Adam Smith was talking about. We've known that this stuff is right for so long. A lot of the minimum wage kind of mantra is a remnant of like the union burst in the early 1900s, because unions operated upon the minimum wage ideal, but they did it by, if you restrict labor, then you can increase the wage, just because the only people you restrict supply, price goes up.
And we got away with it then too, because we were the only economy in the world that was a major, you know, major exporter of technological goods. Now we compete with China, we compete with Japan, we compete with everyone, Europe. And after World War II, we didn't have any of that. So when the union movement picked back up, they could demand higher wages, and it didn't have as much of effect because we were the only one capable of producing that output.
Yeah, this is my main beef with essentially every big institution, is that there is no broad thinking, there is no vision to anything. We're in the internet age. The industrial age has been destroyed over the last 15, 20 years. And we're at the very beginning of the internet age, and everything is changing, and we're pioneers.
Yeah, you can 3D print your buildings now. You don't have to construct them. Just 3D print them.
I mean, if you had gone back to me in 10 years ago, and you had said you can 3D print a building, I would have said, what the heck is that? I mean, think about the cell phone technology that we had back then. I don't see any vision, and this is the problem with government. It can't innovate quick enough. you know, their BlackBerries in a world of iPhone 5s. And, oh, I'm sorry, Greg, I didn't mean to offend you. But it's a great example. I mean, they finally have just figured out how to secure a BlackBerry. What's the version before that, Greg? You know, they figured out how to secure a Motorola Razr.
Yeah, I think that's the torch. I think it was the... I'm not a big tech guy on phones. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the problem, is that they don't innovate. We're at the beginning of the internet revolution, and everything is changing and different, and we just need government to get out of the way because it is not quick enough to innovate.
Well, and that brings us back to the State of the Union, where he talked about, and during this last campaign season, a lot of people talked about, as far as making our schools and the state stepping down and the federal government stepping down and helping educate people for the new tech world and helping get them, you know, what do they call it? Getting them trained, you know,
vocation.
Vocation.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mike Pence talked about that constantly, vocation. But by the time they get their study done, they'll be 10 years behind.
Right. And that's the problem. And we're in a shift now where people are moving from these high-paying union manufacturing jobs to lower-paying service jobs. And, you know, I work in a service industry. I work in advertising, and that's a service industry. We don't make anything. I don't walk in and make a physical product, but I provide a service that, you know, hopefully is good, and it keeps me employed. It keeps my boss employed, and we can hire more employees. We're getting to that point where our work is recognized, so we're getting more people, and it keeps building. We're moving into an era where there's going to be less and less. There's going to be more companies, but they'll be smaller. And if you want job security, start your own business. More people are going to be starting businesses because it's easy to start a service business.
I did.
Yeah, Indy Couriers here in downtown. Greg is a small business owner. You know, my goal is eventually to take this humble little podcast network and make it a media outlet here in Indiana. You know, because I think we're at the beginning, at 29 and at right below 30. In 20 years, this could be a viable business.
You know, I think
25.
I think
you're already lying about your age. Wow,
I am 25. I think
I think the premise of your guys' argument, though, is that the government has the good intentions to try and bolster people or try and prepare people for, you know, it just has good intentions in general.
No, I'm saying get out of the way.
No,
get
I know, but
regulations.
No,
it doesn't have good intention. It's selling good feels. It's not actually showing intention. It's selling the good feels, and that's it.
Yeah, I really do think they want to try. Like last night in the State of the Union, he talked about these modern manufacturing institutes. He wants to, spend $15 billion, and he wants to put them around the country and try to coordinate between private industry and government to help shape manufacturing policy. But there's no way a government bureaucrat will be able to stay on top of market trends. I mean, for instance, like the government websites are still programmed in Java. No young startup company has been using that language in a long time. Like,
right.
if education policy was serious, they'd get rid of the foreign language requirement or let you keep it, but a computer language counted towards that.
Look at there's a video, and I'll post it on the Facebook page tomorrow. There is a video of a kid. He's probably 1 to 3, somewhere in there. I'm not good at guessing ages. They all look alike. And this kid is in front of a Newsweek magazine and is trying to pinch the page and flip it like it's an iPad. He's basically reading a magazine like he would read an iPad. He's trying to get back to the home screen. And we're arguing in our General Assembly here in Indiana whether or not we should keep cursive or not. You know, I learned how to write cursive. I forgot it by sixth grade. I don't know how to type properly. I chicken peck with two fingers. I can type 100 words a minute because I've adapted over time, but I was never taught to properly type in a government school. I mean, it's not arguing for the government to do more or to give us anything. It's just get the hell out of the way.
Well, I think my point is that, you know, government doesn't it can't innovate. It can't get out of the way. It exists to direct the economy by extra market values. It doesn't direct policy based upon what is best for the consumer.
English, please.
What I'm trying to say is that whenever the government does something, it's almost an axiom. The fact that the government, the fact
no
that
no one knows what that word means.
Listen,
we do. They don't.
Damn it.
Okay,
it's too
sorry.
Smart.
The reason. The very
is Reddit. Type it okay. like you're on Reddit.
By the government doing something, it is conceding that the market wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
So it necessarily, by its mere existence, implies that whatever it's doing is not what the market is demanding. So if the market, so what they're saying is that we need to do things to direct the economy based upon a value other than the consumers being happy, other than workers getting training that is necessary. They're saying that we need, and a great example is Obama pushing for green energy. I mean, everybody knows that green energy is unsustainable if it doesn't right. have subsidies. I mean, it costs more money to make ethanol than they get out of it in profit. I mean, they have to subsidize ethanol or else it is totally inviable. They're conceding when they make an economic policy that the value of the consumer is not what they're shooting after. My point is that I think them making policy is implying that they are only doing things for the political purposes. There can be no good there is no good intention for any. It's all about helping out their cronies, helping out those who are their voting base. The union support for the Democratic Party is the best example of this. They do things and they make economic policy sheerly to protect unions from the economy. I mean, anytime I'm just saying,
and that's really all that it is. And by the way, can you put all that text, can you transcribe that and put that on a cat picture so I understand? Thank you. And that's really what it comes down to, is the whole we need to bring manufacturing. And listen, if you've read Peter Schiff's fantastic book, lots of pictures for those of us who can't read, it's How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. Fantastic book, fantastic explanation of Austrian economics.
Have you ever read Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics?
No, because that doesn't have pictures.
No, it's like the greatest introduction to economics I've ever read in my entire life. It's so simple.
It doesn't have pictures. Peter Schiff's book, I read it with like no reading light, driving in Las Vegas in an RV.
Yeah.
And it was perfect. Peter
Schiff did go one step beyond all the others, and he made it so like a first grader could read it.
Yeah, we have a Chad Reed has used that as a textbook in Plainfield High School. So in about 10 years, you're going to see nothing but Plainfield graduates like espousing Rothbard, and it's Chad Reed's fault. It's awesome. His extra credit one year was End the Fed by Ron Paul. Like, so now he's teaching up at Carmel.
That's preaching to the choir.
So it explains why you need a market. You need a manufacturing economy. It's hard to grow a service-based economy, but that's where we're heading. And this whole talk of bringing manufacturing jobs back to America, it's just not going to happen. You know what happens when they bring these jobs from China back to America? It was on 60 Minutes. They've got these robots that last 2 to 3 years, and they do the jobs that they do. It costs them $2 an hour, but it's an American job. Instead of paying a Chinese worker $2 an hour to do this job, they've got a robot doing it.
Yeah.
And you know what it costs them? $20,000 over the course of 2 or 3 years.
It's a no-brainer.
How can we compete with that?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
I mean,
and when are we going to get max minimum wage for robots?
The thing is
the robot labor
people,
union.
The human nature is that they fear, we are afraid of the new, the different, the change. I mean, honestly, human people are just afraid of, you know, the unknown. And the fact remains that, you know, when you move, when you advance economically, it requires changes. So if we existed as a manufacturing country for decades upon decades, I mean, eventually it has to change, because if not, then you don't have any economic progress. If you don't advance, if there is no change going on in your economy, then you aren't advancing. Production implies a reduction in the amount of effort necessary to do something. And what you're saying with robots, what they've done is they say, we can do the same thing that a worker had done with a robot, and it costs us nothing but maybe like one person who can keep the robots fixed. But the thing is it frees up all this labor that was that used to be doing stuff that now can be automated. All this free labor has to go somewhere, and that's what the change is. you know, it has to go into a new industry. The tech industry is the obvious one that's going to subsume it all. But when you make policy to restrict this from happening, you're not helping. I mean, it's the famous that which is seen and that which is not seen, the broken window fallacy. You are helping out the individual people that were in those jobs, because let's say that they had spent their whole life doing a trade and they don't have any other skills, so they get laid off and they don't have anywhere to go but work at McDonald's. You know, they were making, you know, maybe $20 an hour, and it was legitimate $20 an hour. Now they're working at McDonald's for $7.25 because they don't have the skill necessary for a different industry.
But the government's stepping in and saving us. We're going to start supplying all – I mean, Obama said it in the State of the Union. We're going to start supplying all these countries with weapons of war. Bam. Manufacturing jobs right there. We don't need to retrain anybody. We're going to make tanks and bombs and missiles and guns for all these countries that hate each other.
See, and this is – this, but that plays to another fallacy that people – that – you know, the man on the street economist follows. You know,
by the way, I need to clarify half the statements I'm making. I don't actually believe in what I'm saying. I'm being, you know, I'm trying to get him to talk more.
Yeah,
TLDR.
But that plays into another. I mean, it happened a lot with the sequestration stuff. They talk about how if we cut money for defense spending, then they're going to have to stop making as many missiles, and that's going to lay people off, and that's bad for the economy. I mean,
in the short run, though, it is a contraction that has human costs.
It does.
And that's where the Democrats step in and say, oh, my gosh, look what you're doing. Now he's getting ready to retire. His, you know, his retirement account's done.
And the sad thing is that is so much more powerful than the long-term benefits of allowing on a free economy. And that's the disadvantage that anybody who supports the free market is because you have to understand the consequences of a consequence of a consequence of a consequence in order to understand why something is beneficial, you know, from an economic standpoint. The average Joe voter doesn't – they don't have the time to think about that. I mean, it's not necessarily like they're dumb or something. It's just they don't have the time to sit down and, you know, think things through to the point where, you know, they're economists. I mean, that's why people get trained to be an economist. They're the ones that have to worry about this stuff. The average Joe's worried about putting food on the table. He doesn't care about, you know, whether or not reduction in the money supply causes deflation or not. They don't care about that. But the thing – but for people making policy – it's so much easier to sell to say, you know what, we're going to protect this guy who's 64 years old. He's 1 year away from retirement, and if we don't pass this law protecting his job, then it's going to get shipped off to China, and he's not going to be able to retire, and he's going to be thrown onto welfare rolls. We can't have that, so we need to pass this law. Now, his job getting shipped over to China by the market would mean that China can do it better, and then resources are freed up to do things else that other people want.
And that's not going to last forever.
It's going to last.
Currency appreciates.
It's going to last until China realizes that they have enough middle class to sell their goods to.
Yeah.
And they don't need us.
Exactly.
Well, all right. We need to move on because we're getting kind of long on this. Hold on.
Oh, my God. Spengel's drinking vodka out of a huge blue water bottle.
Sorry, I was really thirsty.
I watched him snort something out of nasal spray earlier, too.
What were you guys' thoughts on Marco Rubio?
I will be back.
Okay, what are your thoughts on Marco Rubio and Drinkgate, Watergate?
Was that a joke then?
Yeah.
I thought you just did a joke.
Yes. Yeah, that was a joke. Thanks.
I thought he gave a pretty run-of-the-mill Republican response. He blamed the financial crisis on big government. He appealed to the social conservatives with his very first line, which I was just stunned because I didn't see him picking up that crown of Santorum and carrying that forward. And
yeah.
I was really stunned he did that. The water bottle thing's irrelevant, but...
You can shut that window if you want. It's chilly.
I'm good.
All right. The whole water bottle thing... Listen to me very carefully. And you can tell your Facebook friends this too. If you're not going to vote for somebody because they got nervous and they had to take a drink of water in the middle of a speech, then please stop voting. You're not responsible enough to vote. In fact, you're quite dumb because stuff happens. You know how nervous people don't understand how hard it is to give speeches. I wouldn't vote for Rubio. I'll be honest with you. But I feel bad for the guy because that has to be terrifying. I've trained hundreds of candidates over my time at the LPIN and seen dozens more at the radio station give speeches and debates. It is so scary to do that. and you think you're on national TV, you're in this awkward room, and you have dry mouth, so take a drink. You know, and he's getting killed. So
I think it just illustrates how boring the actual speech was. That was I mean, it was so uninspiring. They were like, well, hell, there's a water bottle he drank out of. Let's talk about that.
My wife was like, can we watch something else? I had to listen to Obama for 10 minutes.
I didn't even watch it because Marco Rubio has absolutely nothing to say that would ever appeal to me. So I want to bring up how awesome the libertarian response was that was posted like 5 minutes before the State of the Union was over.
Yeah, Carla Hal, look up the Libertarian Party Facebook page, and you can check out the video of Carla Hal's response. There was also another one. There was a Rand Paul Tea Party thing. Are we not done with the Tea Party and the Tea Party response yet? I mean, I love if the Tea Party stays involved, but can we just get rid of the name and, you know, like the Tea Party response?
No, until the people that are right now 65 and older finally pass, we're going to have a Tea Party. They still have Social Security to fight for, so we'll still have it. And there's still those weird gays out there, and they need to be dealt with through the enforcement of legislating morality.
That is true.
We have to do something about that. So we will have a Tea Party as long as those gays are out there, and we might lose our Social Security.
Amen.
God bless it.
And those weird transos.
I think they're okay. They're fine with them. It's just the gays. The gays really bother them.
No, I'm defined as an abomination against all natural law, so I'm in a completely different category, and that doesn't really play into politics that well. They just shoot on sight.
We'll get to the LAPD in next. So there's... Thank you. I'll be here next week. The Rand Paul, he got some heat, actually, and I had a Republican friend who was kind of in Rand Paul's camp a little bit, and they said, but they're really like a party person. They care more about party, the Republican Party, than
anything
else.
You got to watch them. They're horrible people.
Yeah. They go, well, listen, I was going to give him the benefit of the doubt, but then he undercut Marco Rubio by doing his speech, so I'm totally against Rand Paul from here on out. And I thought... Maybe not the most logical argument, but I understand why he's getting flack for not being a team player by doing a separate speech, because Michelle Bachmann is one thing. Sarah Palin, did she do it?
I think
like Herman Cain.
Yeah. Herman Cain. Like, okay, those make sense. But now we're like, it's 4 years later. Politicians have largely decided they don't need to pander to the Tea Party anymore. So why are we still doing this?
You mean why did Rand Paul pander to the Tea Party?
Oh, yeah.
I think Rand Paul just placed a huge bet. I think he placed a huge bet on where the party he wants to take the party, and he's trying to get out in front of it and ride the wave.
Oh, absolutely. His whole political existence is dependent upon the Republican Party changing towards like a less social conservative and a more fiscal conservative, even to include defense cuts. I mean, that's his whole political career is dependent upon that fact changing. And I think for him, maybe not for the country in general, but for him in Kentucky, being a senator from Kentucky, I think it's a huge thing for him, because I mean, his whole campaign, like his whole message was the Tea Party comes to Washington. This is a book, The Tea Party Comes to Washington. So for him, I think that absolutely being associated with the Tea Party is still okay. Now, is the Tea Party still viable in the sense as it was in 2010? I don't think so at all. But absolutely, his whole I think by him even running for Senate, he was making a bet that in the future the Republican Party is going to change away from this essentially dominated by neoconservatism philosophy into a more, I don't know, Barry Goldwater-ish kind of philosophy.
I wouldn't go that far, but He's pandering. He's doing what all politicians do. He's playing the game extremely well. And so,
thank God for that.
No, I mean, I commend him on how well he's selling out his constituents and playing the game. And he's being just like everybody else. He's playing the game, I think, if not as good, if not better, than Obama played the game.
Wait, how's he selling out, though?
Oh, he you know, everyone says, oh, Rand Paul's moral and his principles and he's libertarian-esque and I just want to shoot myself.
Hold on. No, he doesn't care. No, I got to go get my popcorn.
Honestly. No. What is he doing? Okay.
What has he done that has that would if make you, him if be
you,
such
if you want to be in politics,
Godzilla.
Godzilla's awesome. He destroyed Japan. So, no. No, I like the Japanese people that make anime. No. What he's done, look at how he treats the political system. Look at what he's done. He will sell out himself or whatever principles he supposedly has just to make sure he doesn't piss off the wrong people. Anyone that's willing to do that is not somebody worth supporting.
But what has he done, though? What has he done that has been so atrocious towards the libertarian
sanctions
philosophy?
In Iran?
Okay, so sanctions. That's one that's always brought up.
That's an act of war.
Okay, sanctions. What else?
I don't follow him that much.
Okay.
I hate him.
My point.
I made my stand when he supported Romney. I cut the line at you supporting the GOP in any way, shape, and or form is against any kind of libertarian morals.
He ran as a Republican.
I don't care. That was his first mistake.
Well, I'm just...
How can you support a party? If you want to change politics in this country and make things better, you cannot support the two-party system because that is our problem. That is where all stems from. You can't worry about bills or this or that if you still have a two-party system, period. As long as you have it, you will not get anywhere.
But the two-party system isn't going anywhere, not because... It's just the nature of how our political system is set up. It's not
That's just the way it is. So we should just deal with it.
No. It's just you have in systems where you have more than one party that are viable are also systems where you have proportional representation. We live in a system where you get 50% in one vote, you win it all. It's just like the incentives set up in that kind of system force you into two parties. I'm not saying that the Republican Party is going to be the second party forever, but to say that because he recognizes that more can be done in the Republican Party than more can be done for trying to make the Libertarian Party or any other party to become viable on the national stage. It's just a matter of resources and time.
That's talking about incrementalism and everything else. That's where that whole theory ends up stemming from is, you know, over time we can change these things. Well, he's talking about right now. He's talking about winning right now. If he really wanted to change things, he would have switched his party label and he'll run as a libertarian again. If he really wanted to, you know, affect long-term good change.
If he ran as a libertarian in 2016 or something?
I don't care. If he did, whatever. I mean, look at Gary Johnson. He helped us out. He used to be Republican. He ran libertarian. He helped us a whole lot in the long term.
You know
what?
Not
just right now, not just for his political power.
I think that sounds awfully like a partisan. I don't think that the goal shouldn't necessarily be to advance a party.
Until we can get rid of straight ticket voting and all the other crap, as long as we have two major parties, the only goal of the politicos that want to break it down is to be to find a viable third party, which, well, the only one in the country, you know, nationwide is the Libertarian Party, so that's the one I'll talk about. But building that is the only thing that we should be worrying about, because that's the number one thing we have to change is breaking the whole left-right crap.
I disagree. I think the overall goal should be to advance
progress in society.
Is to advance the ideals. I think the overall goal is to advance the principles we believe in.
The vehicle's irrelevant.
Yeah, I personally disagree that the Libertarian Party is the best means of doing that. But
you bastard.
But I mean, back to the point I started at. Rand Paul, I mean, he gets hated on. I mean, obviously he gets hated on by people for, you know, one vote and stuff. I got that. But what it ends up turning into is making the perfect the enemy of the good. I love that saying because that is something that is, I mean, a lot of the Ron Paul supporters, they make the perfect the enemy of the good. Rand Paul isn't perfect. He isn't. He's not a perfect candidate. He's done things that I disagree with. I don't agree with sanctions on Iran. But if you take him and you say, all right, let's put all the stuff he's done I like on one side of this line and put all the stuff he doesn't like on this side of the line, I mean, you run out of room on one side of the line because he's done so much stuff I like.
If Rand Paul were a girl, Creighton would marry him.
I'm just saying.
Okay, and you
we'd
know,
have,
the
we'd have Google and Chris Galt witness it.
Yeah, well, no. I just That's not my problem, is not his votes. It'll never be his votes. I mean, the other guy with the Justin Amash guy, as long as you support the two-party system, you are a problem.
But that you don't even vote. You worked on campaigns, you didn't even vote. That's all you need to know.
That's ignoring reality.
But that mentality is such a partisan mentality.
I'm calling you out.
Aren't libertarians supposed to be above partisan mentality?
No.
They
demand ideological purity.
That's right.
No, ideological purity is one thing.
No, we don't.
Partisan purity is another. That sounds like partisan purity. It's not so much that you could be the worst ideological candidate on the planet. It sounds like you're saying as long as they run as a libertarian, they're okay.
No, libertarian, green, socialist, communist, I'll support all of them before I support the Democrat or Republican parties because they're so entrenched because of how the system's set up. So no, it is a little partisan, but not particular to one party, to any viable third party.
But as far as
where I'm concerned in Indiana, it's the Libertarian Party. Nationwide, it's the Libertarian Party. The Greens, the close second behind us. So it's not – I don't care about ideologically purity. I mean, I loved Rupert to death when he ran as governor, and he was kind of a libertarian. purists out there, I mean, he's awesome. But for the purists out there, he wasn't really that great of a libertarian. But that's not where I'm coming from on this. I don't care about his votes. But we have an issue here in this country where we have two parties that are so entrenched we can't get anything done. Not that we want to actually get anything done, but we can't get anything repealed. We can't change anything. So as long as those two are here and we have the tennis match, nothing will change. So you can run 1,000 good candidates. You're still going to have the old money, the old power structures, and everything else. So good luck.
I think if you look historically at how party demographics have changed and how party policy has changed over the past, or at least let's just say since the country was born, more has changed through changing the two parties that existed, changing their underlying ideological base, than has been replacing one of them with another party. The only time it's ever happened was when the Whigs got replaced with by the Republicans. That's the only time that happened during the Civil War.
So well, hasn't it? That whole idea of what you're saying, it's worked so well because look how great our two parties are right now.
No, but my point is that throughout American history, more change has come from a what the parties stand for, quote, what do the parties stand for? More has come through a party's base being shifted.
It's gotten continually worse. So your argument is now invalid because it's gotten continually worse.
No,
so the changes.
You're missing the point. You're missing my point.
All right.
Timeout. Let me finish my point.
You got 30 seconds because we've had this argument on many podcasts.
What I'm saying is that regardless of whether or not, yes, in general, everything's gotten worse over time because the state has gotten bigger. What I'm saying is there are more historical examples of a party staying in existence in name and changing in philosophy than there has been a party being replaced in name. Because the communists are a great example. Communists took over the freaking world. They took over America as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, and they did it in the Democratic Party. They changed this old South Party into what it is today. That is an example of the power that you can use if you know what the hell you're doing. Replacing them with another party took freaking Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War.
But if we had a third party, not replacement, a new, have a third party. You're completely missing the point.
Okay.
Three parties versus two.
I got you on that.
And I'm saying that it's possible in the internet age.
I don't think it is.
No.
I don't think it is.
Our two-party system demands conformity.
It's already changing.
Okay, the perfect example is Ed Coleman ran. The one problem we have is straight ticket laws. We have to repeal one law to get perfect winning streaks every time. Ed Coleman, the horrible libertarian everyone thinks he is, but he did an amazing job. He got, 22%? He got every single non-straight ticket vote. So, I mean, that right there says 22%. All we have to do is, 10% of the population more to vote, and we'll win elections left and right. So saying that, giving up and saying it's too entrenched, let's just play within the system is inane.
No, that...
We got a call timeout.
Your argument is based upon... For your argument to be correct, you would have to assume that anyone who didn't vote straight ticket would have, or anybody that didn't vote straight ticket just didn't vote straight ticket because they didn't want to vote straight ticket. I could just as easily say that anyone who voted that didn't vote straight ticket didn't because they wanted to vote for Ed Coleman to begin with. So he could have only got 22% regardless of straight ticket voting. The ones that were going to vote for him to begin with voted for him, and they didn't vote straight ticket. The ones that weren't going to vote for him regardless of how straight ticket voting or not, they went ahead and voted straight ticket.
The reason it's impractical is because you're depending on a large majority being high information voters. And that is never going to happen in the United States.
No.
Never.
That's not what we're depending on.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Because the Republicans and Democrats, you're pissing both of them off, which is a terrible position to be in. Horrible, because they have the money and the power. And then on top of that, you're depending on an engaged citizenry when we have, what, like 52% of people vote in national elections and like 24 in House elections?
No, we can play off emotion just as the other two parties do. People are dissatisfied where the country is. We give them a third option. We get votes. Bam. Done.
You're going to run emotional ads on electoral procedure.
We're getting the people who did the ASPCA.
It's a little bit deeper.
Sarah
than
McLaughlin.
That. Just look at it from a historical perspective. The systems that have historically been able to have three parties and have them be viable over time have been proportional representation systems. We do not have that.
Mm-mm.
You do not get electoral votes. You do not get any votes based upon your. How much the population votes for you in a proportional sense. You either get 50% in one person and you get all of them, or you get 50% in minus one person and you get none of them. That's it. It's just the incentive structure. It leads to two different parties. That's how it is.
Historically, yes, but you didn't have a completely open. We're heading into an open society. There is a huge difference between where we were 100 years ago and where we are now, as far as the amount of information you can gather, how we communicate with each other, how fast everything is, how we campaign. It changes every single presidential cycle. The things that we did this last election cycle, you know, we never dreamed we could do them. Look at how Obama has revolutionized a campaign technology. You know, the problem with the Libertarian Party is that it needs funding to get to that level.
But that's the point. A party structure isn't necessarily just for communicative purposes. It's a resources thing. It's you only have so many resources. You only have so much money. You only have so many people, and you only have so much time. So it makes more sense in a first past the post system to coordinate all the resources of people in a big tent towards one party. Rather than it is to split it up amongst various different sub-parties.
I had this conversation this week with somebody who was thinking about running in the Republican primary. This person wants to challenge a long-standing House of Representatives member here in the state house. It is just as difficult, maybe even more difficult, for this person to beat a sitting state house member than it is for a Libertarian to do it, because it takes more money in a primary. You have to convince all the right people who have entrenched interests versus your random voter.
You have to do that if you're running against him as a different party. You have to, because you're competing for the same votes.
You're not competing with the same votes with straight ticket voting. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difficulty that Libertarians have, is that no matter what you do, you still have a block of stupid voters who just want to save time and hit one button, and they don't care about any of the down-ballot races. They don't have any incentive to learn about the down-ballot races, so they just hit the button with the chicken.
They want a sticker and to feel good about being a citizen.
Yes, right. But there's states that have abolished straight-ticket voting, and they still don't have viable third parties.
No, I mean, the Libertarian target market is the highly informed voter. That is who you guys target. That is your base.
Hold on. The reason it is that way is because of the candidates that we have run. If you were out with Rupert, campaigning with Rupert, highly informed voter, I don't think they ever really came up to us. I mean, and I don't mean to say that mean, but Rupert was a different strategy than the Libertarian Party had ever tried. We were going after the 70% of people who don't vote because they didn't feel like anybody represented who they didn't speak for them, or they didn't vote because they just had never thought about it. They never had connected with anybody, and you know, we saw people who would never come up to a political booth come up and be engaged for 20 minutes. They'd stand in line for 20 minutes to meet Rupert and be engaged and take the world's smallest political quiz and get literature and get informed, and they go, this makes sense. You know, a lot of what we did with Rupert's campaign was plant seeds here in Indiana. The numbers, he doubled the percentage in the gubernatorial race from 4 years ago, same with Gary Johnson. I don't know how much of Rupert's campaigning had to do with that. I don't have any data to give you, I guess. But I will say, anecdotally, and the results that we've seen afterwards, we just have to do things that are outside of the box.
Like, well,
you know, for so long, we've been running brainy candidates that only appeal to people's intellectual side, and never anyone like Rupert who appeals to people's populist emotional side.
And I'm getting the same response when I appeal to people in the LGBTQ community, is that those people are mostly Democrats. And, I mean, you know, historically anyways. And I appeal to them on a libertarian standpoint on the simplest of things. So it's how some people might see it from within the system, from within our little party here. But we do not try, especially after watching what Rupert accomplished, we don't have to try to get the intellectuals out there. That actually turns more people off than not. Plus, that creates more tension and arguments. So we can, you know, use the, you know, that's what I've been kind of doing, trying to do with my website and everything else, is using the Rupert theory, is that just be simple, be friendly and happy, and you'll reach everybody.
Because, and that's what we try to do here, we libertarians. We try to give everyone a balanced view of what a libertarian is and a positive view, because you can go get all the anger in the world at a lot of different libertarian websites, and I just don't think people respond to that. And you know, you're right, there is a definite attraction that libertarians have. They are attracted to intellectuals, to professors.
Well, they've invested time in developing their personal political philosophy.
Right.
So they're naturally attached to it. And like the thing I think, and I never ran a libertarian campaign or anything like that, but you have such an already built-in advantage with Republicans north of the Mason-Dixon line under 30. I don't know a single Republican of my friends that I would consider a moderate Republican that doesn't support pro-choice, gay marriage, and then are a fiscal conservative. But they don't even understand and realize what the Libertarian Party is.
But
that's why I think it's such a huge advantage to work within the system, because you can pick them off.
I talk to so many of those people, though, and the reason that they believe what they believe – not the reason, but a reason – is that the Libertarian Party exists and runs against them in general. They run campaigns. I talk to so many people that I compete against, and they become more libertarian over time as I've known them, because they're competing against other libertarians. And that is also part of the Libertarian Party's goal, is to move the other parties more libertarian and introduce ideas into the debates.
Well, that just plays into our point.
Yeah. I mean, under 30 Republicans are the biggest advantage the Libertarian Party has, in my opinion. You can get them all, unless they're the Southern, you know, Southern Republicans.
If you're a Republican and the Libertarian Party gets to spread its message until November. If you're a libertarian in the Republican Party, you might get to... I know so many Ron Paul Republicans in Indiana who kept their mouth shut because they didn't want to get outed. And so many of them got disenfranchised in 2008 and 2012. I'm not going to sit here and be quiet. I'm not going to sit here and hopefully achieve my goals in silence and network and cloak and dagger type BS, when we can go out and convince people that they should be libertarians now. You know, that it's just as hard of a road whether you're in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or as a third party. It's plain and simple. I've done both for an equal amount of time, and it's just as difficult. It's just unique challenges in each way.
But if you get inside the Republican Party, if you become a big enough base inside the Republican Party, I would bet anything that becomes the tipping point.
You mean
for change.
Like Maine? And I mean, it just they've rigged the rules against wants to have more of a populist view in the Republican Party.
The fundamental problem that the Libertarian Party faces is that Americans, they look at it as a two-party thing. That's just how it's been for 200-plus years. I mean, the only time you can think of it any differently is when Teddy Roosevelt ran the Bull and Moose Party, or when Ross Perot ran the whatever, Progressive Party or Populist Party, whatever it was,
Reform
Party. The thing is when the people voting, they may like Republicans might like libertarian ideas. The some Republicans, your low information average Joe voter, might like libertarian ideas, but they hate Democrats more. So the image that you put on running as a libertarian is you're taking votes away from us beating the Democrats. And rather than try and change human nature to an extent, I mean, literally fight culture that has existed for 200 plus years.
It's kind of what we did with the blacks, and now we're doing with the gays.
No,
that's
not true.
You know, screw it. Let's not fight social culture and what has historically been true in this country.
No.
Let's not fight that.
No.
Let's keep
culture
it as it is.
Already
and
changed.
Let's be the anti-libertarian here and centralize power into two parties. Let's just change one of them so we like it a little bit more.
But
let's centralize it instead of decentralizing the power in the party system.
You're talking about...
No, I don't, you know, that's what you're talking about. What's passed
the,
along?
No,
the problem...
No,
the problem.
No, you're talking about stuff as you wish it would be.
No,
I will make
stuff
it.
As
no,
it is.
With all due respect, Creighton, you're just wrong about certain things, because if you're in the Republican Party, you're also trying to fight human nature. You're trying to fight a power structure that is entrenched, that wants to maintain its power. There are people in the Republican Party that you will never, ever be able to get to and never be able to persuade that set the rules. They make the decisions. And even if there are 100 Ron Paul delegates, there are still 150 to 300 Republicans that are going to be loyal. And we're not talking about like the – these are people that you don't know their names. I know who they are because I'm involved in politics. And I'll tell you guys off air. But there are people who, if you want to run for a statewide office in the state, there's a couple specific people that have to approve your candidacy because they have access to all the money. And they're not giving up their power just because you have a bunch of rabble-rouser kids in holy T-shirts. Now, that's just the plain truth of it.
But that problem is independent of whether or not you try and run as a libertarian or as a Republican. Those people are – they have the same pool regardless of whether or not you run as a Republican or you run as a libertarian. If you run as a libertarian, you are their enemy the whole time. If you run as a Republican, you may be their enemy because they disagree with you, but you at least you have the benefit of having the structure that has already been set up.
But you're still in a political system
that has a tennis
match.
You're never going to win a primary. That's my point. You never actually get a chance to plead your case to voters.
And even after you get in office, you're still in a tennis match. You're still having to play, and depending on what bill you're allowed to introduce and what bill you're supposed to vote
on,
back and forth.
Have we not learned any lessons?
But that'll happen with the Libertarian Party.
Have we not learned any lessons from... Have we not learned any lessons from Ron Paul's campaign and what the Republican Party did with the Ron Paul crowd? Ron Paul was extremely well organized. Ron Paul it started to go, the wheels kind of went off the bus with Jesse Ventin towards the end there. But Ron Paul was well funded. He had great grassroots, probably as
the best.
The best out of any of those Republican candidates. And it didn't mean anything because the power structure changed the rules.
What he did with Iowa and what he did with Nevada. He completely changed the state Republican Party.
For every one shining example of positive examples that you have, we have 49 other examples of where things went wrong.
And for every example you have of libertarians succeeding, I have about 100 of them failing. I mean,
it's more like 1,000. But
more like 1,000. But no, my the thing is you're saying that if we have a Libertarian Party of three parties, Libertarian, Republican, Democrat. Let's say we have a Libertarian, Republican, Democrat. And let's say that they start getting into Washington, that there is a bunch of people in a Libertarian caucus in Washington. You can just look to Europe to see what happens with third parties over there in a proportional representation system. All that happens is they get subsumed into one of the other parties because the other party says, we'll do something to make you join us. And they join them.
Okay, you're just assuming the worst of everything. It's okay, that could happen. That could be a very big possibility. Also, unicorns could just fly out of my ass. I mean, it's one of those things. If we want to be vigilant and take control of our political system and in the internet age, because you're applying to things to different countries and different time periods, let's talk about right now, today, the internet age, where everything's completely different than it ever has been before at any point in time in the history of humankind, is that we have the ability to keep on things. We have the ability to keep things going. Now,
to organize.
I'm gonna go, you know, to organize, to keep things going. I mean, here I take half of what I know about the Republican Party from me interacting with it, their candidates, and within it, and from Chris Spangle here that tried his darndest to fight in it. And he's not just some uninfluential blob. He's somebody that has some pull and has a name.
I'm just a blob.
Well, now he's just a blob. He's nobody now. But no. So if you want to keep the status quo.
I'm just a nobody now. Thank you.
So if you want to keep the status quo and you just want to keep having these parties bounce around on their on what philosophy they happen to, you know, follow today, fine. That's okay. And we'll keep going the exact same path we've been going for the last 200 years. Okay, down and spiraling down. To change it, three or more parties until we eventually just get, you know, nothing happens and the government defaults and we no longer have a government.
All right, last word, Greg, because we got to wrap up. We didn't even get to Christopher Dorner, which is the whole reason you were on the podcast today.
Well, I mean,
distractions, that's what you are.
The real reason I say this is right now the Republican Party is more vulnerable than it's been in a really long time. Demographic wise, they're graying and dying off. They have no young people coming in, and they are starting to realize they have to change their platform. When you were operating within the Republican Party, it was W. Bush mania. It was 9/11. Oh my God, we're going to get bombed every other weekend. And people, the Republican Party consolidated, and they were the party in power for 8 years. But right now, this last election showed how screwed they are going forward.
I actually have a great story about the point I'm trying to make is back when Bush v. Gore, they asked after Florida results finally came in and Gore ended up losing everything, they asked Ralph Nader if he was ashamed that he ran and essentially the amount of votes he took caused Gore to lose Florida. And they asked him, now, after the Al Gore has lost, do you feel ashamed that you caused your party to lose the presidential election? And he said no, because it's about time that the Democratic Party pays attention to its progressive base and not its conservative base. And the next time they made a rout was in 2006, and the next president that won in the Democratic Party was the progressive candidate, Barack Obama. His strategy of with inner party, because he's ran as green, he's ran as other parties all the time. His strategy of running within the party changed what they actually started doing policy wise.
And we still have two parties.
All right, so final word. I get it, because I'll turn off all your mics off if I don't get the last word. I've been trying to get you people to shut up for 20 minutes. The problem is, without third parties shaming the two major parties, you eventually get a watered-down version of what they're supposed to believe. What does a conservative really believe these days? Really conserving power, maybe? There's really not a clear-cut definition of what a conservative is. It started with Goldwater. You know, that is the problem. That's been my warning to every Young American for Liberty group or every college student that I've talked to. Karl Rove worked in the basement of the RNC in 1964, he was the head of the College Republicans and working for Barry Goldwater. Goldwater was his hero. He was his Ron Paul to most of our listeners. And now look at Karl Rove. He's totally detached from where he was in 1964. And power and money and the parties have a way of making you detach from what you truly believe to get more power. And that's just that is also human nature. It's the plain and simple fact of it. And without third parties there running, reminding people and giving people a third choice, maybe someday people will start waking up. For the first time ever here in Indiana, a congressional candidate, Rex Bell, won precincts. Never had a congressional candidate win precincts. You know, that's a huge step for the Libertarian Party. So who knows what the future holds? I mean, I've made my choice and I'm happy with my choice. And I'm not going to give it up just because, you know, somebody has a different opinion. I'm happy that anybody tries anything anywhere, as long as it moves us towards libertarianism. I just know the seduction of power, and I'd rather stay as close to my principles as possible. All right, final words. We didn't even get to Chris Dorner. This one's going to be a long episode, so thanks for hanging in, if you're still there.
One sentence needs to be mentioned on Chris Dorner.
Hold on. Man, you people, it's the beer. That's what it is. You people are drinking. All right, so we're going to go around. We're going to go round robin. We're going to end with you, Maya. Just give us your brief take on the Christopher Dorner situation that's going on in L.A. Let's start with Creighton.
Guy was mad at cops, killed cops. Cops killed him back.
Very succinct. Greg?
Then they burned him.
Then they burned him. I have found this story to be outrageous. I'm pretty was disgusted last night. It really takes a lot to make me angry and to surprise me and to get me outraged. I mean, I have a joke that's a joke, but it's not that far off. The last time I was outraged was when KFC took mac and cheese off the menu, which is back, by the way.
They did. Okay.
They did. They brought it back because they saw my Facebook post, and clearly. So I was outraged. I'm sitting there watching this, thinking, did we just watch on national television the police burn someone alive? We don't know if that was the person that owned the cabin. We still don't know if that was Christopher Dorner. He tried to run out, and U.S. Marshals pushed him back in the house, and then they lit it on fire. Should we put the fire out? The police radio said. No, because there's still a corner of it that hasn't burned. When did they get the when did they make the decision that they could be judge, jury, and executioner? This goes hand in hand with the drones that we talked about last week. Where's the due process? Are we have really become a nation of the rule of men and the rule of passions and emotions and not the rule of law. And this man was pretty hard to defend. He was a murderer. He was a bad person. He was a nut job. But he should have had his day in court, period.
Exactly. And it's not so much about what we learned from this and what we saw and what the media failed to report on. And I tried to document the best I could on the Indianapolis cop blog page on Facebook. There's a lot of good links on there that are mostly all the true stories. But is what we tried to document ourselves out here is that the cops, the LAPD, they're the scum of the earth. Because they were shooting. They put 40-something-odd rounds in the back of a blue truck when they're looking for a black or gray truck. They shot multiple innocent people. They militarized their entire police force, put roadblocks everywhere. They broke into over 600 homes without warrants. When they broke every rule in the book to try to find this one guy when he was across the street from their command post. And then last week...
Old white woman... Nice try, Dorner.
Yeah. I mean, last week they said they found his ID and his wallet at a boat dock when he was trying to get a boat that somehow magically had the tow line wrapped up in the whatever. That was stupid.
Hold on now. This is the next great conspiracy because every time there's one of these big incidents, I open up my Facebook feed and it's 100. Oh, this is a false flag. Clearly, this is the United States government orchestrating something. All right, this is weird, and I'm really sort of... Something is not making sense with all this. It's just something is not right. This guy's wallet and his ID were found on February 7th in San Diego by the Mexican border, trying to sneak into Tijuana via boat. This was reported in the L.A. Times. Not Prison Planet, not Natural News, the L.A. Times.
And then parroted.
And then, yeah... Today, the USA Today had an article about how they had found his wallet, and that's how they identified the body.
Now, let's say they found his wallet after reporting, after about 20 minutes of the building being set on fire purposely by the LAPD, which there's audio logs out there of them actually saying they did that, and that was the plan. But we'll get back to that, I guess, at some point one day down the road. But they said they found his body, and they pulled it out, and they confirmed his ID. ABC reported that, and that was parroted by all the mainstream news. But now, finally, they're saying they have found his wallet in a home they set on fire and watched it burn completely to embers. And they still found his wallet and his ID.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because the LAPD is just that good, somehow they magically protected his wallet in the fire or something.
Something's just not right.
And then, during that whole thing, they're up on the mountain. They're blocking traffic from 20 miles away. You know, about an hour before they decided to set the cabin on fire, you won't see any good shots of the cabin. They forced all the helicopters, all the news people way far out away from it. So, that's ridiculous in and of itself. But everything the LAPD did, that the mainstream news just act like it wasn't a big deal. They completely went martial law gangster thug in that whole thing. I mean, they technically kidnapped 250 children or skiers up on the mountain and wouldn't let the parents come up the mountain to get their kids in a ski resort cafeteria that wasn't that far away from this whole debacle. I mean, I made a joke that, you know, tomorrow's a future headlines like LAPD starts forest fire, 5,000 people die, Dorner still loose.
So, all right. So check out, what's the Facebook page where people can check it out?
The Indianapolis Cop Block on Facebook. It's just facebook.com/Indianapolis Cop Block. And
What is Cop Block?
Cop Block is a decentralized organization about police accountability where we actually go out and film the police and keep things up and try to help people that are, you know, that get kicked in the face while they're handcuffed or, you know, beat up by cops, and try to film that and help them out in court.
So do you have a game plan for when you finally get arrested?
Oh, they're going to kill me. I'm going to be the next, you know, okay, I'm not going to say that. They're going to treat me like they treated Chris Dorner. They're just going to kill me.
Okay, all right. Let's wrap up. Any final words, Greg? Anything to watch out for in the next week?
No, I'm all set.
All right, Creighton?
Do you think that the LAPD will change as a result of this?
No.
Oh, you're cute.
I'm serious. No, do you not think that this is such a this has been such a huge thing that they might actually have, like,
this has
been media might. I know, don't put your faith in the media, but do you think that after this there might be some sort of, like,
I think this is worse than Rodney King.
Yeah, I think it is too.
And I think that even though that guy was nuts, there's some validity to what he was saying because people have so little faith in the LAPD, and I think it really will lead to some navel-gazing and some reforms, and I hope it does because, you know, here's a guy who's screaming about police brutality, and then they just basically explain what he's talking about at every turn.
I was watching the news today, and they were, you know, Fox News, of course, was trying to say...
Man, you really are becoming a Republican.
Oh, I watch them all. I probably watch MSNBC more than I watch Fox News, tell you the truth. Just because it's always fun to watch the exact opposite of everything you believe.
Love a good clown show.
They were doing a story about, they were trying to basically make these people look bad because there was an internet movement that they sided with Dorner.